Children of Dune by Frank Herbert, continued, Cassette 8, Side 2. What you of the Chome Directorate seem unable to understand is that you seldom find real loyalties in commerce. When did you last hear of a clerk giving his life for the company? Perhaps your deficiency rests in the false assumption that you can order men to think and cooperate. This has been a failure of everything from religions to general staffs throughout history. General staffs have a long record of destroying their own nations. As to religions, I recommend a rereading of Thomas Aquinas. As to you of Chome, what nonsense you believe! Men must want to do things out of their own innermost drives. People, not commercial organizations or chains of command, are what make great civilizations work. Every civilization depends upon the quality of the individuals it produces. If you over-organize humans, over-legalize them, suppress their urge to greatness, they cannot work, and their civilization collapses. A letter to Chome, attributed to the preacher. Leto came out of the trance with the softness of transition which did not define one condition as separate from another. One level of awareness simply moved into the other. He knew where he was. A restoration of energy surged through him, but he sensed another message from the stale deadliness of the oxygen-depleted air within the still tent. If he refused to move, he knew he would remain caught in the timeless web, the eternal now, where all events coexisted. This prospect enticed him. He saw time as a convention shaped by the collective mind of all sentience. Time and space were categories imposed on the universe by his mind. He had but to break free of the multiplicity where prescient visions lured him. Bold selection could change provisional futures. What boldness did this moment require? The trance state lured him. Leto felt that he had come from the Alam al-Mithal into the universe of reality, only to find them identical. He wanted to maintain the Rihani magic of this revelation, but survival demanded decisions of him. His relentless taste for life sent its signals along his nerves. Abruptly, he reached out his right hand to where he had left the sand compaction tool. He gripped it, rolled onto his stomach, and breached the tense sphincter. A pool of sand drifted across his hand. Working in darkness, goaded by the stale air, he worked swiftly, tunneling upward at a steep angle. 6 times his body lengths he went before he broke out into darkness and clean air. He slipped out onto the moonlight wind face of a long, curving dune, found himself about a third of the way from the dune's top. It was the second moon above him. It moved swiftly across him, departing beyond the dune, and the stars were laid out above him like bright rocks beside a path. Leto searched for the constellation of the Wanderer, found it, and let his gaze follow the outstretched arm to the brilliant glittering of Fum al-Hut, the polar star of the south. "There's your damned universe for you," he thought. Seen close up, it was a hustling place like the sand all around him, a place of change, of uniqueness piled upon uniqueness. Seen from a distance, only the patterns lay revealed, and those patterns tempted one to belief in absolutes. "In absolutes, we may lose our way." This made him think of the familiar warning from a Fremen ditty, "Who loses his way in the Tanzeruft loses his life." The patterns could guide, and they could trap. One had to remember that patterns change. He took a deep breath, stirred himself into action. Sliding back down his passage, he collapsed the tent, brought it out, and repacked the Fremkit. A wine glow began to develop along the eastern horizon. He shouldered the pack, climbed to the dune crest, and stood there in the chill pre-dawn air until the rising sun felt warm on his right cheek. He stained his eye pits then to reduce reflection, knowing that he must woo this desert now rather than fight her. When he had put the stain back into the pack, he sipped from one of his catch tubes, drew in a sputtering of drops, and then air. Dropping to the sand, he began going over his stillsuit, coming at last to the heel pumps. They had been cut cleverly with a needle knife. He slipped out of the suit and repaired it, but the damage had been done. At least half of his body's water was gone, were it not for the still tense catch. He mused on this as he donned the suit, thinking how odd it was that he'd not anticipated this. Here was an obvious danger of visionless future. Leto squatted on the dune top then, pressed himself against the loneliness of this place. He let his gaze wander, fishing in the sand for a whistling vent, any irregularity of the dunes which might indicate spice or worm activity. But the storm had stamped its uniformity upon the land. Presently, he removed a thumper from the kit, armed it, and sent it rotating to call Shai-Hulud from his depths. He then moved off to wait. The worm was a long time coming. He heard it before he saw it, turned eastward where the earth-shaking susurration made the air tremble, waited for the first glimpse of orange from the mouth rising out of the sand. The worm lifted itself from the depths in a gigantic hissing of dust which obscured its flanks. The curving gray wall swept past Leto, and he planted his hooks, went up the side in easy steps. He turned the worm southward in a great curving track as he climbed. Under his goading hooks, the worm picked up speed. Wind whipped his robe against him. He felt himself to be goaded as the worm was goaded, an intense current of creation in his loins. Each planet has its own period, and each life likewise, he reminded himself. The worm was a type Fremen called a growler. It frequently dug in its foreplates while the tail was driving. This produced rumbling sounds and caused part of its body to rise clear of the sand in a moving hump. It was a fast worm, though, and when they picked up a following wind, the furnace exhalation of his tail sent a hot breeze across him. It was filled with acrid odors carried on the freshet of oxygen. As the worm sped southward, Leto allowed his mind to run free. He tried to think of this passage as a new ceremony for his life, one which kept him from considering the price he'd have to pay for his golden path. Like the Fremen of old, he knew he'd have to adopt many new ceremonies to keep his personality from dividing into its memory parts, to keep the ravening hunters of his soul forever at bay. Contradictory images, never to be unified, must now be insisted in a living tension, a polarizing force which drove him from within. Always newness, he thought. I must always find the new threads out of my vision. In the early afternoon, his attention was caught by a protuberance ahead and slightly to the right of his course. Slowly, the protuberance became a narrow butte, an upthrust rock precisely where he'd expected it. Now, Namri, now, Sabiha, let us see how your brethren take to my presence, he thought. This was a most delicate thread ahead of him, dangerous more for its lures than its open threats. The butte was a long time changing dimensions, and it appeared for a while that it approached him instead of him approaching it. The worm, tiring now, kept veering left. Leto slid down the immense slope to set his hooks anew and keep the giant on a straight course. A soft sharpness of melange came to his nostrils, the signal of a rich vein. They passed the leprous blotches of violet sand where a spice blow had erupted, and he held the worm firmly until they were well past the vein. The breeze, redolent with the gingery odor of cinnamon, pursued them for a time until Leto rolled the worm onto its new course, headed directly toward the rising butte. Abruptly, colors blinked far out on the southern bled, the unwary rainbow flashing of a man-made artifact in that immensity. He brought up his binoculars, focused the oil lenses, and saw in the distance the outbanking wings of a spice scout glittering in the sunlight. Beneath it, a big harvester was shedding its wings like a chrysalis before lumbering off. When Leto lowered the binoculars, the harvester dwindled to a speck, and he felt himself overcome by the Haddab, the immense omnipresence of the desert. It told him how those spice hunters would see him, a dark object between desert and sky, which was the Fremen symbol for man. They'd see him, of course, and they'd be cautious. They'd wait. Fremen were always suspicious of one another in the desert until they recognized the newcomer, or saw for certain that he posed no threat. Even within the fine patina of imperial civilization and its sophisticated rules, they remained half-tamed savages, aware always that a kris knife dissolved at the death of its owner. That's what can save us, Leto thought. That wildness. In the distance, the spice scout banked right, then left, a signal to the ground. He imagined the occupant scanning the desert behind him for sign that he might be more than a single rider on a single worm. Leto rolled the worm to the left, held it until it had reversed its course, dropped down the flank, and leaped clear. The worm, released from his goading, sulked on the surface for a few breaths, then sank its front third and lay there recuperating, a sure sign that it had been ridden too long. He turned away from the worm. It would stay there now. The scout was circling its crawler, still giving wing signals. They were smuggler-paid renegades for certain, wary of electronic communications. The hunters would be on spice out there. That was the message of the crawler's presence. The scout circled once more, dipped its wings, came out of the circle and headed directly toward him. He recognized it for a type of light thopter his grandfather had introduced on Arrakis. The craft circled once above him, went down along the dune where he stood, and banked to land against the breeze. It came down within 10 meters of him, stirring up a scattering of dust. The door on his side cracked enough to emit a single figure in a heavy Fremen robe with a spear symbol at the right breast. The Fremen approached slowly, giving each of them time to study the other. The man was tall with a total indigo of spice eyes. The stillsuit mask concealed the lower half of his face, and the hood had been drawn down to protect his brows. The movement of the robe revealed a hand beneath it holding a Mala pistol. The man stopped 2 paces from Leto, looked down at him with a puzzled crinkling around the eyes. "Good fortune to us all," Leto said. The man peered around, scanning the emptiness, then returned his attention to Leto. "What do you do here, child?" he demanded. His voice was muffled by the stillsuit mask. "Are you trying to be the cork in a wormhole?" Again, Leto used traditional Fremen formula. "The desert is my home." "Then," the man demanded, "which way do you go?" I travel south from Jacarutu. An abrupt laugh erupted from the man. Well, Bartigue, you are the strangest thing I've ever seen in the Tanzeroft.
I'm not your little melon, Leto said, responding to Bartigue. That was a label with dire overtones. The little melon on the desert's edge offered its water to any finder.
We'll not drink you, Bartigue, the man said. I am Maurice. I am the Arifa of this Taif.
He indicated with a head motion the distant spice crawler. Leto noted how the man called himself the judge of his group and referred to the others as Taif, a band or company. They were not, each one, not a band of brothers. Paid renegades, for sure. Here lay the thread he required. When Leto remained silent, Maurice asked,
Do you have a name?
Bartigue will do.
A chuckle shook Maurice. You have not told me what you do here.
I seek the footprints of a worm, Leto said, using the religious phrase which said he was on Hajj for his own Ummah, his personal revelation.
One so young? Maurice asked.
He shook his head.
I don't know what to do with you. You have seen us.
What have I seen? Leto asked. I speak of Jacarutu, and you make no response.
Riddle games, Maurice said. What is that, then?
He nodded toward the distant butte. Leto spoke from his vision. Only Shulak. Maurice stiffened, and Leto felt his own pulse quicken. A long silence ensued, and Leto could see the man debating and discarding various responses.
Shulak.
In the quiet story time after a siege meal, stories of the Shulak caravansary were often repeated. Listeners always assumed that Shulak was a myth, a place for interesting things to happen and only for the sake of the story. Leto recalled a Shulak story. A waif was found at the desert's edge and brought into the siege. At first, the waif refused to respond to his saviors. Then, when he spoke, no one could understand his words. As days passed, he continued unresponsive, refused to dress himself or cooperate in any way. Every time he was left alone, he made odd motions with his hands. All the specialists in the siege were called in to study this waif, but arrived at no answer. Then a very old woman passed the doorway, saw the moving hands, and laughed.
He only imitates his father, who rolls the spice fibers into rope, she explained. It's the way they still do it at Shulak. He's just trying to feel less lonely.
And the moral?
In the old ways of Shulak, there is security and a sense of belonging to the golden thread of life.
As Maurice remained silent, Leto said, I'm the waif from Shulak who knows only to move his hands. In the quick movement of the man's head, Leto saw that Maurice knew the story. Maurice responded slowly, voice low and filled with menace.
Are you human?
Human as yourself, Leto said.
You speak most strangely for a child. I remind you that I am a judge who can respond to the taqwa.
Ah, yes, Leto thought. In the mouth of such a judge, the taqwa carried immediate threat. Taqwa was the fear invoked by the presence of a demon, a very real belief among older Fremen. The Arifa knew the ways to slay a demon, and was always chosen,
because he has the wisdom to be ruthless without being cruel, to know when kindness is in fact the way to greater cruelty.
But this thing had come to the point which Leto sought, and he said,
I can submit to the Mashad.
I'll be the judge of any spiritual test, Maurice said. Do you accept this?
Bilal Kaifa, Leto said,
without qualification. A sly look came over Maurice's face. He said,
I don't know why I permit this. Best you were slain out of hand. But you're a small Bartigue, and I had a son who is dead. Come, we will go to Shulak, and I'll convene the Isnad for a decision about you.
Leto, noting how the man's every mannerism betrayed deadly decision, wondered how anyone could be fooled by this. He said,
I know Shulak is the Al-Asuna Wal-Jamas.
What does a child know of the real world?
Maurice asked, motioning for Leto to precede him to the thopter. Leto obeyed, but listened carefully to the sound of the Fremen's footsteps.
The surest way to keep a secret is to make people believe they already know the answer, Leto said. People don't ask questions, then. It was clever of you who were cast out of Jacarutu. Who'd believe Shulak, the story myth place, is real? And how convenient for the smugglers or anyone else who desires access to Dune.
Maurice's footsteps stopped. Leto turned with his back against the thopter's side, the wing on his left. Maurice stood half a pace away, with his mala pistol drawn and pointed directly at Leto.